Why is there that kernel of our deep personhood that is able to be expressed in food? It speaks to how food touches us so deeply.
We are women encouraging and equipping women to universally and uniquely serve Christ in their feminine vocation.
By embracing joy, laughter, freedom, and friendship, we are seeking to thrive in the trenches of our domestic churches.
Welcome to Thriving in the Trenches podcast. This is Becky Carter.
And this is Megan Schreiber. And today you are listening to episode number 20 of Thriving in the Trenches podcast. This is our last podcast of our first season, of which we just spent the last few having a summer series. So we're wrapping it up with a little light conversation about food and friends. Our theme is food, family, and friends. We're very blessed and excited to have Katie Curtis joining us. Katie is an author and food blogger. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, ladies. I'm so excited to be here.
Katie, I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about yourself and your family for our listeners.
Sure, I would love to. Well, I grew up in a big Irish Catholic family in Chicago. I was the sixth of eight kids, and we had a really fun, like, big, joyful family with lots of personalities, and we loved getting together with other people. We loved big dinners, and we had a lot of ups and downs, but I looked back when I became a mom, and I realized that the guiding force through them all was really my mom's desire to show love to us and just making us a yummy dinner every night, and the safety and the security that that family table brought to me as an individual really shaped me. And I think when I became a mom and tried to piece together what was important to me, I really pulled from that. We had, like I said, just a lot of personalities and a lot of fun together. But my dad, who was a trader on the stock exchange in Chicago, really suffered when the 87 crash happened. And so we went through a period of difficulties where his depression came out and sort of froze him, and we had to move, and we went through like rocky financial times. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing to me that even when we went through a time of want, my mom was still able to scrap together like cheaper and cheaper meals because they were from scratch, because that was, you know, going to buy processed food or things like that for families is more expensive. So I kind of saw this side of food as being sort of her area that she could control in the situation, but she made the best of it. And she also like poured a lot of her creativity into it. She had studied in France. So like, I think it was during the time that Julia Child was like taking off in America too. Mm. So she really had like a French background, which is really frugal, like when you think about French farmers and stuff. So it was just this like very nice, way to give to her family and for us to receive. And she was very Catholic. We went to, you know, I think they had the Latin Mass when we went to church in Chicago. And so we would, you know, go, she would get eight kids dressed and all off to church and make these great dinners. And it looking back, it's a wonder like how you did it all under duress sometimes too. Mm-hmm. And I think when I became a mom, my situation was that I really looked at like sort of the conversations at the dinner table as being a big piece of my learning, and it made me really love to learn. And so I really loved school. I excelled at school, and I got into academics. I went to Boston College, and then I majored in economics, but I really was interested in philosophy and writing as well. And when I was in college, my dad passed away. Mm-hmm. I was 19. And somehow we still got together as a family. I remember the day he died, I went home and my mom was making like sandwiches for everyone, like Reubens or something, just to comfort everyone, you know, in our shock and such. And so as I went on, he was in finance, obviously. And so I was an econ major and I went into finance, and I was really busy in corporate America. It's where I met my husband. And I loved going out to eat and eating good food. I still like love that aspect, but I didn't have a desire to like make food then through my 20s. Mm-hmm. And then I definitely was hungering for truth. God was working in my life, and I thought the path for truth would be to return and be a philosophy professor. So I went back to school and I was studying that. But as I left corporate America, my husband's like, no, we belong together. So I became a wife and we lived in upstate New York when we first got married. I remember directly across the street from a Wegmans, which is
good,
like,
place.
This mega superstore that's mind blowing in the quality of their products. And he did travel a lot. So I was like a newlywed. I was teaching at a little liberal arts college called Nazareth College in upstate New York in Rochester. And I had a lot of free time. So I was lucky that I had a year before kids where I was interested in food and I just poured all my free time into like reading the cookbooks we got when we got married and remembering, like, I just couldn't believe how many memories of my mom's cooking like flooded me when I was thinking about shaping my own family. Wow. So slowly but surely, I would call her and be like, how did you make the like lemon zucchini with sour cream on top? Or how did you make your barbecue sauce? Like, I would call her and write down the way she made things. But I also was interested in it from just a curiosity perspective. Like, I don't know if you guys can do this, but I could sit down and read a cookbook cover to cover. Because I was like so interested. Yeah. So we just like got to teach myself how to cook in that window. And I totally know that if I had little kids underfoot right that moment, it might have been a little hard, still hard, I think. I don't know, because I had three kids in 3 years right after that and decided I got into a PhD program. And then I was pregnant with my first son. And then I decided to stay home. And I just remember how like food was sort of like my joy in my day, like cooking dinner was like the chance I had to still learn, be creative, bring something, you know, as my kids got a little bit older and started eating table food, bring something to them. It just became like a backbone. Like you guys talk about thriving in the trenches. It was the way that I was able to thrive because I was able to access learning and like different cultures. And, you know, if I made fresh pasta or pasta sauce, I felt like I, you know, thought about Italy that day, you know. Aww. In my isolation as a new mom, I was able to still, I felt like, have a little bit of access to the world and learning and growing. So that's kind of how I got it into it. And by the time my third daughter was like maybe like a year and a half, I read a book called Will Write for Food. And it was about food writing. And I had thought about becoming a writer now that I quit my PhD program to stay home. And I thought, you know, I could freelance write about food, or, you know, I knew I wanted to write about food. So I started the food blog and it was a new world. Like, I don't even think I would be on Instagram if I hadn't been a food blogger first. But it was definitely a way to grow and it shaped me. And it helped me grow as a writer, as a food blogger. I definitely have horrible pictures in my first entries. And I definitely know that I don't love the way that food, like they call it food porn. I don't love the way that there's so much information coming at us about food. I really love how food tells a story, how like you can go back and remember like what you ate on your honeymoon with your husband. Like, and you can go right back to that moment. I like, you know, those kinds of how food is a story. So I try to keep my food blog a little bit story oriented, as opposed to other food blogs. But it led me into writing and I decided to try my hand at a novel, and there's a lot of food in the novel. I don't know if you guys read Lord of the Rings, but do you know how Tolkien describes like hobbits love food and coziness and like their pint of beer and they're like toast and tea or whatever. I'm like, I'm such a hobbit.
I know I want a hobbit with you, Katie, because you're always talking about food and I can just, we're going to share like a day's worth of meals together sometime for sure.
It is so fun to like think about that. Yes. I love doing that with my friends. So yeah. So and food is like a secondary character in the novel. And, it led me to, right after I finished that, start a food memoir of growing up in the large family. And now that the novel's finally done and edits are in, I can turn back to that. I'm about halfway done. So that's awesome. My story.
Wow.
Very good.
It's a great story.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So, tell us, what does your daily life look like now? Tell us about your family.
Well, my kids, it's amazing when they get older. Oh my gosh. I mean, I know you guys have been through it. So when they become independent and self-sufficient, it's just a different day. So my kids right now are in fourth, third, and second grade. And then my preschooler is 3.5, almost 4. And then we are expecting another one in October. And
they congratulations.
Thank you. I know the big kids are so thrilled. I loathe their bus time. It's 7:05 in the morning. I'm definitely a night owl. And motherhood is like reshapes that in me. So yeah, we're up at 6 and we're, you know, busy, you know, filling out, you know, like forms and spelling tests and all that stuff in the morning and getting them out the door. We say the morning offering every day when they leave, and we try to cram them with a healthy breakfast, which is so challenging and when they're not hungry and it's like so dark out. And then once they're off to school, the littlest and I have like an hour together to just like cuddle and pack his lunch for preschool. And he was going 3 days a week, but he loves it so much that they said, oh, do you want to send him some extra days? And I was really busy with the novel edits. So I sent him, but I let him stay home any like day that I can because I love hanging out with him. So I pick him up right after lunch at 1:00. And so in that morning is really when I have time to work. I write for a couple of magazines, Coastal Home and New Hampshire Magazine. And so I would fit in my time to write freelance then, and I would do whatever I needed to do on the book. And then I pick Andrew up and we have a little time together. He loves outside, so we like we'll spend time outside if it's not too cold, or maybe run an errand. And then the big kids come home at 2:10. And so they have some snacks and a little downtime for them. And then 3:30 is like homework and 5:00 is dinner. And I just can't wait so we can play outside because all that time is so much better when everybody gets to have fun together outside. Mm-hmm. And then, like 6:30 we eat dinner. And then, we try to find something fun to relax and do at, between 7 and 7:30. And then we try to kick everybody in their beds at 7:30 to read because most of them have like a chunk of reading time they have to do for school. And mm-hmm. luckily my kids all love to read.
I'm like, that's awesome.
I don't care what sport you play or whatever, but like they have picked up a love of reading. So that part's usually fun. But man, I cannot speak highly enough of charades at that time because everybody gets their facilities out and it's so interesting to see how much kids absorb. They're like sponges and they absorb nuances and characters so that when they're doing charades, it's like you see exactly how their mind works. So I can't recommend it highly enough, but that's usually the day. And my husband is home for dinner like maybe one or two of those nights, Monday through Thursday. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes he has business dinners or functions or like a lot of conferences he has to go to. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I'm solo, but I do try to like get a babysitter and go to like book club and mom night out when I can, so I get a break.
Great. Well, I have to say, if your husband is traveling a lot and are not there, kudos to still cooking great meals because, dude, that's usually when I'm like, okay, it's peanut butter and jelly, popcorn for dinner, ice cream for dinner, you know, whatever makes them happy and gets me off the hook.
Oh my goodness. I can't even tell you guys with this, I'm in the period of nausea where I have food first. It's like I see it more clearly how much it means to me because there's just like nothing more relaxing to me than chopping vegetables and stir frying them and like just making dinner and talking to the kids while they're doing their homework. It's like such a pleasure to me. And I know it's not like that for everyone. And I really miss it now that I can't do it, but pretty soon at Easter time, I'll probably feel better.
Yeah. So that gets into the seasons, right?
Yeah. So there's definitely times you can't cook. Like when we have busy sports schedules or like, you know, programming like shows and plays that they have to go to at school and stuff. I think food and cooking shouldn't be a burden. It shouldn't be like an imposition. It should be like just like a chance to like dive in when you can and when you can't. You know, obviously doing the best you can, but like appreciating all the more the times that you can really take time to cook and sort of enjoy the process. It's sort of like a meditation to chop, right?
Right.
So it's a good time to just turn on music, have a glass of wine and sort of relax. instead of making it a chore, like it can be a relaxation if you kind of take pressure off yourself. But yeah, seasons for sure. We're in one where, we have a lot of tacos and pasta right now, Becky and Megan. And, there's no shame in that. Like there's obviously, you know, should be like a grace that you give yourself for when you can cook and when you can't.
That's right. And you know what? I think the key piece that I heard you saying when you told your whole story, the theme that kept coming out and was resonating with me was that atmosphere that your mother created around the table. And it was that, that intimate community of family and that stability too in unstable times, right? There was always something that was predictable, no matter how unpredictable life was. And that I think is such a comfort for, I don't even want to just say children, teenagers. It's a comfort for me too, you know, at the age, you know, in my 40s. So that's so much of what was resonating with my heart. So even in the season of mac and cheese or a bowl of cereal, Becky, if it's about knowing that predictability of we're going to be sitting down together as a family, right? As an intimate unit, as a domestic church, that just makes so many of the outside issues fall away. And I
it
can,
really does.
Doesn't it? You know, and I can remember that too, growing up, that family hour was so important and it was that predictable outcome that I could always expect when oftentimes my world seemed upside down. And it's great when the kids are little. I mean, they love that. And it's almost more necessary when the kids are teens. And that's when it's a harder challenge because we're seeing the world, you know, pull at them for things that we do want them doing, like forensics and sports. But it does cut into that family time at that hour because that seems to be when most of the activities are. So then that's, for us, we shifted to guarding our weekend time. You know, I think that's important too. And that's like the family meals will happen on the weekend. If it means during the week, we're kind of eating in shifts around the island based on who's driving whom and what time somebody has to be where, that's what's going to happen. But so long as we're together on the weekends, having a family meal, it's just so great. And I can see too, with our teens, the more they want to linger at the table, you know, and it's not just eating and running. It's like, they're kind of pulling their chair back a little from the table and propping their leg up on their, you know, starting to really get comfortable, and the conversations just start flowing. So it's just that I think that food, that family time, and, you know, draws so much in and is reflective back on that domestic church. It's that basic unit of family.
It is. It strengthens that unit in such the ties are so bonding. I was telling Becky, you know, it's almost like if we're the domestic church, you know, Christ set up this example that Eucharist and communion and coming together over a shared meal is a nourishing way to strengthen our bond with Him. It follows that it's the same thing with our family and those relationships. And I look forward to the teenage years for that reason, like, because I think it's a way to, like, stay connected with your teens, because I was like that, and so are my siblings, that we, you know, would start to get into politics and we could analyze them through, like, you know, a lens of social consciousness, but, you know, with virtuous living. So it was able to, like, filter all world events through, like, our Catholic conscience. And that was really important. And it was very shaping, you know, like, I think I carried that out into the world always.
Right. That's great. And I love to hear that you say you're looking forward to the teenagers. And if there's one thing that I can get through to our listeners, just being the slightly older mom on the show, when my children were little, there was a lot of the message from maybe the media, maybe the world, that, you know, teenagers are a burden. Boy, they're hard to deal with. They're opinionated. They're messy. They're all of these things. And I kind of feared it. But then I started to have teens. I was like, what are they talking about? They are awesome. They're great. Yeah. They have so much to contribute. They're growing into really beautiful people. Yes. Do they have opinions? Well, yeah, but don't we want them to, right? So don't we want them to have that ability to exercise their growing maturity in their mind? I mean, yes, they still don't have a frontal lobe, but it really is awesome. And I think every parent should not look towards the teenage years like, oh my gosh, what's coming? They should look at it like, yes, this is awesome. So I'm glad that you said that.
Yeah. And thanks for, thanks for saying that, Megan, because I have really realized that having my first teenager hit the house, in December, I really appreciate hearing that and being reminded of that, because the messages from the world about teenagers is terrible. Mm-hmm. And I look at my daughter and I just think, she's becoming a little more difficult to manage in times, but it's only because I don't know what I'm doing yet. And I keep telling her that. I'm like, okay, just remember, mom and dad don't know. We've never raised a teenager either. We've never had a 13-year-old. You've never been 13. So we're all learning this together. I hate the way the culture has kind of made mm-hmm. teenagers like this evil, dumb, foolish.
I am borrowing that line, Becky. That's so sweet and so understanding. Mm-hmm. And it garners their empathy for you as you go through instead of making them super bitter or, you know, having a clash of wills. So
we're on a journey together, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could unpack that whole topic of loneliness, because it's like, it hit me in motherhood, because I came from such a boisterous, like, fun. Every time you turn around, somebody was bringing home Sam Adams and we were sitting around a campfire. And I came from such a fun environment that to then move to upstate New York, where it like rains or snows every day. Mm-hmm. Just kidding, upstate New York. so to be like, and my husband traveling, and you know, fortunately I had work I loved, but I didn't have any kids at that time. And then we moved to Saratoga Springs. That's where like we had our first two children, and I was there with little littles and 18 months apart, and you know, getting sleep with two kids under two is just a challenge. Right. So I was tired a lot. And it makes you draw inward and sort of, you're just in survival mode getting through the day. And it's really hard to break through isolation at that time. And also I think, I don't know if you guys experienced this, but I didn't even know what to name it. It was just like, why is life hard right now? Oh, it's hard because I used to have connection with everybody all the time, every day. And now I have like my three fun neighbors across the street, but I really can only talk to them like on Thursday night when my husband comes home, or something like that. And we would try to like have our kids play together and, make dinner together if our husbands were traveling, and they were a really big blessing. But it was, again, it was around food. Like we would be like, oh, okay, your husband's gone 3 days, so is mine. We even made a food swap thing where we would all cook on Sundays, and then we would make three of the dinner, and then we would share it with the others so that we only had to cook twice during the week. And that was fun, and it brought us together. But other times we would just go over to each other's house and we'd all like cook dinner. And then we moved again, and I was in a neighborhood where I didn't have that. And once again, I like missed it because, oh my gosh, like that was such a touchstone for me. And then here I am totally isolated again. And that's when I really got into Ina Garten. She became my friend. You know, I had another period of growth and learning about food because I was isolated. But then we happen to move again to a neighborhood that's pretty vibrant, for the kids to have like more friends and a better school system. So, so it does, it takes you by surprise, I think, when you're in a period of isolation, because you might've come from something different right before that. And it takes a while to name it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Do you guys feel like that?
Yeah.
Feel like, oh, what is wrong? Oh, it's because I'm not getting fed in that way of nourishing relationships.
Sure. Katie, that's a big topic, because I think that there's, you know, hearing your journey, there was literally the physical isolation, right? You're in a new place, a new land, a new home, making new friends, trying to reach out, settling down, and then doing it all over again in a different place. Mm-hmm. There is literally that type of isolation. And then there's also the type of isolation where people are in community and they feel isolated. And it's that spiritual isolation. The basis of it is that hunger, right? That longing, that ache in our heart, right? So that eternal ache. And so, yes, it's about that community piece. And then that when you're in community and there's still that ache, sometimes it is that spiritual ache for God, right? That we're always going to have. But I think what can counteract that isolation when you are in community or you're in a vibrant parish or you have a great network, but you feel isolated, I think it's taking a look at maybe where the time is spent, or, you know, are your friends uplifting you? Are they leading you to God? That's like another topic that we've talked about in a previous mm-hmm. episode is that friendship piece. So I think isolation can also come not just from the physical piece, but also from the inability to talk about issues that people really need to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's so true, especially I'm Catholic in New England, which I guess, I don't know what is, I think I've heard from both your stories that like where you live geographically is not, there's not a plethora of like people who are trying to live an authentically Catholic life. And it's certainly true here. People have been so gracious and lovely announcing our fifth pregnancy. But our fourth, people would just look at us and be like, you guys are crazy. And trying to communion with people who are trying to, you know, raise their kids with that spiritual aspect is definitely a challenge. But I think it's also a blessing to think of it as our way of being a missionary just in our own community. I know you guys have mentioned and love that quote by Mother Teresa where, you know, it does not, you don't have to go to the slums of India to try to be a saint. You can do it. Love your neighbor, like just bring them over a pot of soup when they had surgery. Like,
right.
I think for me, one of the things that we do, especially in the winter, and I didn't do it this year because I'm pregnant, but in years past, I just throw a soup and bread, and I just make two big pots of soup and tell everybody to bring their kids over. More frequently, we just call Friday night, like come over and we'll order pizza. Hospitality doesn't need to be in Ina Gerton's kitchen making her souffle. It really is just opening your door and not caring how messy your house is and not, not worrying about, you know, if you have the right napkins out. None of
right.
that. It's about just opening your door and being like, it's an open house. Like anybody wants to come over. And that has broken up, especially in the winter months. And we do travel and go ski and have our family meals up north. But on Friday nights, a lot of times, so we stay connected to our community, we'll try to just do that. Just different sets of families, some of the kids' friends, you know. And that really keeps us connected and nourished to some of our relationships. And I think we try to... we try to make sure that our shared values of, you know, the kids and like trying to live a life where we're, sort of moving forward as a family, is what comes out in those conversations. So it doesn't have to be like, you know, we all go to the same church because some of them are Greek Orthodox and some of them are Jewish and we love it.
Right.
But it can be like just, try, as you said, Megan, not all friends lift you up and make you closer to God. But I think being that friend for other people is sort of what is in our control.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So you're like a food missionary. it's a new title.
Yes.
Right. I'm just going to crack your door down with a casserole.
Yes. Yes. Yes, exactly.
I am awesome.
Yeah. Or pizza from the local pizza parlor.
Yeah. Hey. There's nothing wrong with pizza. You know, one of the, listening to what you're saying about inviting people in, even though your home isn't perfectly put together, my home is rarely perfectly put together ever, maybe once in a year. And, when I had younger kids, and I still have little kids, but when I was in the thick of everybody was little, I can't remember who it was, but it was an older mom, and she shared with me one of the best gifts that you can give a friend or even a mom that's younger than you is to invite them over and do not clean your house.
It's so true. As you were saying that, I was going to say, it is such a breath of fresh air to see someone walking in their imperfection or their mess or their whatever. And it, even if like our friends come over and they've been fighting and they share that they've been fighting, we just like take a deep breath inside because like, oh, we had a rough week too, you know? That's a great point. And that is a very good piece of wisdom.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing that I really heard you say that, that stuck out was that when you You mentioned the seasons of loneliness and isolation. And in one of your seasons, you just kind of, Ina Gardner became your best friend. And you spent a lot of time with her. And I'm sure the people that get to eat your food are thankful for that. But right now it's still the dead. Well, it's technically spring, but it's still, the trees don't have all their leaves and, you know, all it. So we're still in the fall, the winter, and it looks desolate, but spring is right around the corner, and it's during the winter that those trees are preparing to bloom and they are preparing to show off with all of their God-given majesties, right? Which is what he's done in us in those seasons of isolation. He's growing us. And so when we get into our season of spring, God's creation in us, what his work in us, we are revealing his majesties in our seasons of spring too. So I know it's hard to see it when you're in the depths of loneliness and isolation. And I definitely get there in the winter months too. But the beauty of the spring is just even more beautiful whenever you've had those seasons. And then you can spot others who may be in those same seasons too.
Yeah.
You can come around and say, look, it's totally normal. Don't shame them into feeling bad that they're lonely. Don't shame them into feeling bad that they feel isolated. You know, they just probably need somebody to hear them.
Absolutely. And sort of, reach out to them and be like, hey, do you want to have a play date? So it's not like a very overt thing where I'm like, I'm picking up that you could use some, you know, a friend or something just to open your door, just invite them. And that's a really beautiful thought, Becky, to think about it. And I actually didn't really realize it till you just said it, that how much growth is still taking place, even though, you're not, all of your needs aren't met. I'm an extrovert. But I guess that personality type is like the most introverted of the extroverts. So like, if you can't get your extrovert's needs met, you'll get them in an introvert way. And, so I think during those times of isolation, when my extrovert needs aren't getting met, I tend to read more. I tend to learn more. And I'm, like you said, like just like God is using the seasons on nature, he uses those seasons to grow other parts of us. So that's really beautiful.
That's awesome. That's so critical to think about, that those dormant stages, they're really not dormant. I mean, there is something always going on. And when we have the open heart and open hands, Becky, that you chatted about in probably our very first episode, that's when the opportunity to grow is so available, right? When when we're waiting on God, when we're waiting through possibly a difficult season, to have the open heart and the open hands makes such a difference. And it seems strange for me to draw this back to food right now, but the food piece is really so beautiful, because I can remember a season for me that I was very private about, but obviously somebody picked up on. And you know what? She just showed up at my front door with a loaf of Irish soda bread. And the beauty of that was I had tasted hers maybe a year before somewhere. And I was like, wow, like I'm 100% Irish. I was like, this is great. A lot of people don't really know how to do this well. And she remembered that, you know, so she not only just brought me something, she brought me something that was personally uplifting for me. And, you know, it was almost like she didn't even have to say anything. That was just such a deep connection, reminding me that I'm known, reminding me that I'm seen, and reminding me that there are people out there that are available to me. So that even though we might be feeling isolated, it was just this very small gesture to say, you know, I am here when you're ready.
That's beautiful. And it speaks to how food touches us so deeply. Like, I'm interested in, why is there that kernel of our deep personhood that is able to be expressed in food or connected through food? I think that's just a neat thing that God gave us as a gift, the vehicle he chose to like, be with us always.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's so everyday and it's so common and it's so easy to look at it as unimportant. We were just studying for my daughter's first communion this week. So we were just talking about it. But it's so special that he chose such an everyday, ordinary, common vehicle because everyone throughout the ages will have access to it.
That's right.
I love how the Old Testament talks about the manna from the when the Jewish people were trying to find their promised land. I so often feel like the Jewish people, like, just grumbling, like, God is not even giving me what I want right now. Like, this is so hard. We should have just gone back to be slaves because at least we had food. I would have totally been like that.
And that is totally what was, that was part of what was driving the Israelites back. Okay, this is one of my favorite. I love the story of the Israelites and the desert. And this is a beautiful connection, Katie, for the piece about feeling isolated when we're in the trenches sometimes, but they were in their trenches and they were in the desert and they felt isolated like nobody's business, you know? And but what they wanted to go back to in Egypt,
slavery.
Mm-hmm. In slavery was food.
Yeah.
That's what they wanted. They're like, well, at least we knew we had food, you know? Oh man, sorry. I love that story, the Israelites.
It's true. And the manna is such a precursor to the Eucharist. I'm always blown away by how much God had planned everything that happened when you go back and read the Old Testament.
Yeah, right.
I think that, but it's such a great thing for us because what God was trying to lead them to was freedom. And through the wild, they're grumbling. And I feel like that all the time. Like, I know you're trying to give me good things, but this really is not comfortable.
Yeah. Right. But they had to go through the desert to get to the promised land.
Yes.
And we have to go through our desert to get to the promised land. Mm-hmm. We are currently in the desert.
Right.
And we are trudging along, waiting and seeking the bread of life as our manna to get us through to get to the promised land. And, you know, yes, we're going to grumble. We're human, you know. Mm-hmm. But we also have this great community to encourage us and hug us when we need to be hugged, kick us in the booty when we need to be kicked in the booty, you know. And but, gosh, without community, it's just...
Right.
I don't know.
Right. You know, and to not to keep going on that topic, but you know how close they were to freedom and that they were willing to go back to slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Then how many of us do that on a daily basis? Whatever's enslaving us, right? Is it a repeated sin? Is it a repeated lie that we listen to and we believe, you know, and how close we always are to freedom on a daily basis. And that is just locking in the gaze of Jesus, and we're so close. And sometimes we think it's okay to be enslaved. Like that's just like, no, we just got to keep moving forward. Right. And even if it's just, we're living on that manna and we're going through the desert is to lock eyes on Christ and to keep moving forward away from the slavery.
Yeah, Megan, that's so important. I totally agree. I think we live in a culture where we think it's okay to be enslaved. Christianity has been watered down so much, and the call to holiness has been lost. And, I'm a sinner. You know, God forgives me. Yes, you are a sinner. Yes, God forgives you. But you are a child of God, and the risen Christ resides in you. You are no longer called to a life of enslaved or being enslaved to sin. You are called to a life of freedom. And the lie that, I'm a sinner, that is a lie. And it's from the evil one. And we are called to be free. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah,
that's a soapbox for me.
It's one of our pillars, right? When we talk about kind of our mission of thriving in the trenches of our domestic church, we talk about joy, laughter, freedom, and friendship. And that freedom element is probably the most misunderstood and most confused. And I was one of them for sure who misunderstood it. I can remember, you know, I'm going to paraphrase St. Augustine's quote, but it was like, love God and do whatever you want. And I remember hearing that, and I was like, how is that possible? I just don't think that's possible. Because if, I mean, loving God means I'm going to have to give up so much. And like, how I'm going to love God and then I'm going to, what? I can do whatever I want? No. Because I was in that enslavement. I was restricted by what loving God meant. I was staying in this lane with guardrails up because what I wanted and loving God weren't in the same lane. And then it's until you realize like, oh my gosh, like authentically loving God, I want what he wants. I don't even want those things that were pulling me away from him. We think that's what we want, but that is total slavery. Freedom is that other side. And he nailed it, St. Augustine. Love God and do whatever you want, because that loving God and seeking God on a daily basis, our wants are different. They're the desires that he places in our heart, right? When we're delighting in the Lord.
I love that.
Yes, I know. And it's all stuff worth meditating about. I find that as a topic, this stuff kind of grows and matures as I get older, or, you know, progress in my faith, because it just keeps taking on more depth and more richness when you kind of think about all this stuff, like, what does it mean? And I do think that, you know, there is such a paradox to being a Catholic or Christian, that to follow Jesus means to take up your cross. And just like Peter denied Christ three times, like, we're so tempted to have that shortcoming of our, you know, human nature trip us up. But then when we realize how much love and freedom come on the other side of the cross on Easter Sunday, then it's, yeah, you can't help but want anything else, because it's you being authentic and you being in authentic communion with love itself. So,
amen.
Yeah, it's so good. And I'm going back to the image of your teenagers creaking their chair back and relaxing. Isn't that so free? Like, it's a chance for sharing a meal with someone is a chance for them to be their freest self. It's like when you go out on a date night with your husband and you have a meal, like, don't you guys feel like letting your hair down and you're just suddenly very free with them?
Right.
And I think, I don't know, it's just a gift to be able to do that.
It totally is.
I want to talk a little bit about, you had mentioned in one of our conversations about cooking with the seasons and how that goes into living the liturgy, which I love doing. And of course, you've seen me post about this St. Patrick's Day. It was Lucky Charms, and that was all I could muster up this year. But just talking about the seasons, the church seasons, the actual, you know, seasons and the nature and all that, and how we can wrap that up and include our community with food.
Yeah. I think this is such a great point. When we were talking before about the seasons, like, I love this quote by C.S. Lewis where God knows that we need consistency and change at the same time. So he gave us the four seasons because they're always changing, but we always know what to expect. It's a rhythm. There's like such a rhythm into it all. And I can't believe I've only grown a garden for 4 years. And if you don't have time to grow a garden, if you have little babies, like, don't put pressure on yourself.
It's
just
a lot,
maybe take your kids to the farmer's market. But getting your family in touch with the seasons and letting them taste, you know, a fresh ripe tomato, a fresh ripe strawberry, a fresh ripe peach is to me such an essential piece of like sharing in the gifts God like just naturally gave us, you know, sort of our Garden of Eden. I really do look at like the seasonal eating that way. Our the chance to it. And my mom didn't, when we were growing up, she always made a point on how Lent comes at such a beautiful time because we have feasted so much over the holidays. Like almost everyone I know was grumbling. Like, I just need a week of not drinking. Like, I just need to lay off the sugar cookies. Like everyone was sort of saying the same thing. And we're all groaning as people because we've overindulged during the holidays and the seasonal time. And plus, like, I don't know, we need an extra like layer of like flat fat when we are like, up in New Hampshire, and my husband and I both say we like gain like 5 pounds or 10 pounds in the winter. So I think that it's just like naturally that you like sort of indulge when it's cold. And then once it's starting to get nice out, you sort of want to eat healthy and like your appetites, if you dial into your appetites, you sort of crave exactly what the earth's bounty is giving you right at that time or what the church's calendar is offering you. So you get this chance to cut back at Lent. And then right after that, it's like, the earth is giving you like asparagus and fiddlehead ferns and like, you know, fresh eggs again are like plentiful. And so you start making omelets and frittatas and quiche. And so like Easter cooking is so fun because it's like the first produce that is becoming available. And then, you know, you go into the summer and I think just being tied to, we're lucky that we have a little farm that grows and lets you come and pick like blueberries and strawberries, like right around the corner from our house. So our kids can go and do that. And one of the things we do, to tie us to seasonal cooking is we get, like we buy like a half cow from a farmer in Vermont and we have a white chest freezer in our garage. And I tell this to people all the time because it really makes meal planning and dinner planning easier because we get a ton of ground beef in that. So that's all hamburgers and meatloaf and tacos. And then we also get cubed beef. So that's like kielbasas in the summertime, or sorry, like kebabs, you know, so like grill and just do stuff. And then that's beef stew in the winter. And it's almost like I've been amazed at how the better cuts of meat line up to holidays. So you have filet mignon for Valentine's Day, you know, and you have like, you know, bone in rib roast for Christmas. And then you have it makes us sound like we're really crunchy and foodie, but my husband's cousin, they actually raised pigs and then just slaughtered them. And so he gave us, we bought a pig from him. So we had ham and bacon and those things. So at Easter we had that ham. And they're just knowing where our meat came from tied us to our food and to like eating seasonally in a really cool way that I didn't like go out, seek out on its own. It just sort of happened by having it. And I think when you tie those things together, just like, you know, where your meat came from and it's all healthy. So you know that your kids are getting, you know, good grass fed beef. And then you have just the seasonal produce that you're picking up that, you know, what is available and in season and is going to be by its nature, very delicious because it's in season. Then you end up having really good food. You don't have to.
I'm hungry.
I know.
Can I have a big slab of bacon with that filet mignon? Because I am hungry and it's early.
Exactly. So, yeah. So I think, so just dialing in that way. And I have actually learned a lot from people on Instagram. We didn't grow up cooking like a king's cake on Mardi Gras or some of the other sweets that people who I see live liturgically do make, but I'm interested and curious in trying to incorporate those, and little by little I am, but I think just sort of taking what God has sort of like, just to call it the low hanging fruit, just to take what's available right then, inspires you in a way, keeps you connected to God's gifts. It keeps you connected to wanting to give those good gifts to your family. And it does, it ends up making the food taste better.
That's great.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, Katie, I know you have piqued my personal interest in all that you're doing and all that you're cooking. And I know that you have a food blog called The Humble Onion. And could you tell our listeners a little bit more about the two book projects that you have underway and have completed?
Yep, sure. I say to people, when I only have an hour or two, I cook and food blog. And when I have 3 or 4 hours, I write. just like people are like, why is this person doing all these different things? But I do, they're outlets of creativity. And I've always been a big reader. And I think my writing hit its stride when I was in grad school for philosophy, writing a lot of papers. So when I decided to stay home, I just had an idea for a novel, and we live in a beautiful area, and we're about 2 hours away from Mid-Coast Maine, which is like, some people have heard of Booth Bay or Bar Harbor, and just north of that is a town called Pemaquid, where my husband introduced me to when we first started dating. His family goes up there every summer. So the novel is called The Wideness of the Sea, and it's set in Pemaquid, and of course the characters in the book love to get together around food, but it's about an artist who starts out in New York City. We meet her there. She works at a gallery, and she has to go home suddenly for a funeral because her uncle dies. And when she goes home, she has to revisit a lot of the pain from her mom passing away 8 years earlier. And in that, it left her dad's relationship with her very strained. And she also left her first love, the gentleman that she was dating at the time. She knew she needed to like escape Maine and was feeling suffocated from her dad and the memory of her mom. So she wanted to go to New York, and he wouldn't come because he was a lobster fisherman. And so the lobster fisherman rights are like passed down generationally. So you can't really like leave and come back. Like someone would take over your territory. So he was like, I belong in Maine. And I think you do too. And she's like, nope, I have to go to New York. So we meet her when she's already like built her life in New York. And she has a boyfriend and friends and a great job and a great boss at a gallery who's a funny New Yorker. But when she goes home, she sort of revisits all of the parts of herself that she buried when she left. Because I think grief has that ability to do that. It can strengthen some of those bonds and hurt people, hurt others. So like when our family's hurting, we can sometimes lash out at each other. So she sort of had to weave through a lot. But she does, through grace, find a way to sort of calm her own pride and her own hurt, and to try to reach out and learn more about what other people were going through and forgive. And it's sort of a story of her healing. So that is the novel. And then there is a lot about Maine and nature and art in it. And then the food memoir is, as I mentioned, it's just this telling the story of our family through food. I got really interested in food memoir as a genre. There's so many terrific books out there. If anybody's just looking to geek out and like has to like convalesce and just like read books, just take a stab at the food genre category. So like some of the oldest ones are like M.F.K. Fisher. She wrote about How to Cook a Wolf, which was writing cooking in the times of the Depression. So like it's a joke because she, you know, like there's nothing to eat. So like there's like a wolf at the door. The wolf was hunger itself. So you start with her, and she has like a whole body of work. And then you get into some of the more recent ones. We went to France 2 summers ago. My husband like bid on a house in an auction and won. So it was a really inexpensive trip to France. I know, it was like a dream come true. He totally did it for me. While I was there, I was reading a lot of French food memoirs. So like My Life in France by Julia Child, and David Leibovitz is like an amazing food writer, and he's a great food blogger. He actually was interacting with me on social media, on Instagram, and telling us where we should go to eat. I was like, oh my gosh, I love modern social media. While I was there, I was like reading all these food books, and I whipped through Ruth Reichel's body of work. So she is the editor of Gourmet Magazine, or she was like for like 10 years. And she just became the New York Times food critic, and she just happened to love writing about food too. And she told her story of growing up. And I think all these writers together, as I was like immersed in that genre, like started to make me realize that I thought it would be such an easy way to tell our family story, because there's so many different chapters about food in it, and when it was important and when it wasn't, and how sort of spiritually impoverished we were when food wasn't important. It was interesting connection for me. So like almost like doing the Examen, that prayer where you reflect on your day and you look at the events of the day and how they impacted you can see God's hand at work in your life. The writing the food memoir like completely made me realize that, oh, I think he made us go through those times of want to grow closer to him, because it's awfully easy to get swept up in the world and sports and what the neighbors think if you're successful and you're doing well. But when you're in times of isolation or in times of want, sometimes that's when he's drawing him closer to you, like you closer to him. So that's so far writing it. That's what it made me realize. And it's made me incredibly grateful.
Does a food memoir have a title?
Yeah, it's called First You Make a Roux. It's just like a funny phrase my mom used to say as we'd walk through the kitchen when she was making prima broccoli soup or chicken pot pie or anything like that. She'll be like, first you make a roux, in her French accent. And I thought it just encapsulated the spirit of the book.
That's awesome. Katie, you have been an awesome guest. You have made me hungry. You have made me want to go pull and dust off some of my Ina Garten cookbooks. And also, you've kind of reignited in me the desire to be able to go back and get in the kitchen, even if it's just for one night of the week, that where we're really gathered around the table and not eating in shifts around the island. So thank you for taking your time and being our guest today.
Thank you guys so much for having me. You guys are so fun to hang out with. I can't wait to do it in person.
Absolutely. Let's do it. So guys, thank you for joining us this week. We are so grateful for all of you in the trenches. You can find show notes on thrivinginthetrenches.com. Please subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes, and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where you can join the conversation. Thanks for coming.